Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. Today we are going to do, in this session, Chapter 3 of The Murder of Little Mary Fagan by Mary Fagan, Mary Fagan Keene. And remember, this was the famous case from just about exactly 100 years ago that resulted in the creation of the ADL to defend the Jew, Leo Frank, the pedophile, the rapist, the murderer, and also the resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan coming out of the lynching of Leo Frank. Lynching, of course, is the term they usually use for any extrajudicial killing. It's always carried out by a vigilante, not to say a mob, and they load the words the best they can, but the real criminals here were not just the Jew, Leo Frank, committing the crime, but the Jews who arranged to lie about the crime in the papers to try to somehow, by blackmail or payment or some other means, they got Governor Slayton to commute the death sentence of Leo Frank, which is what led to the lynching. They got him out of jail. They dragged him back to Marietta, where Mary Fagan was from, and they hanged him. And we've already done the introduction, chapter 1 and chapter 2. Today, Vanguard Audiobooks, which you can find at vnnforum.com, we're going to do chapter 3. I'll begin. Chapter 3, My Search Begins. And we've heard in the earlier chapters about what it's like to be named for Mary Fagan, which the author of this was. She wrote the book in 87. Mary Fagan was 13 when she was killed in 1913. And so this girl has grown up, and her father, she in chapter 2 recounted her father's hearing, are you by any chance related to Mary Fagan? And she kind of gone over her family's whole history in dealing with the case, and how they've dealt with the public who has asked them about the case. This was very widely known all over the U.S., but particularly in the South, and particularly in Georgia, where they were from. So, My Search Begins, Chapter 3. The dream was always the same. The funnel-shaped cloud was the largest I had seen, and it was heading directly for me and those I love. Miraculously, my brother Michael found a cave in which we could be safe. The cloud destroyed everything in its path, but those in the cave remained safe. Screaming and sweating, I would awaken with my heart palpitating and then realize that it was only a dream. But I became afraid to sleep for fear that the dream would come back. And it did, again and again. The story of Little Mary Fagan had indeed followed me to Florida. And when we left Chapter 2, she had just gotten admitted to Flagler College, and her goal was to teach the blind and the visually impaired, teach them reading and stuff. And this would be, I think, in the 60s, this point. Again, this is Mary Fagan, the author, speaking. And she was named by her father for her great aunt, and I think his aunt, Mary Fagan, the victim. The story of Little Mary Fagan had indeed followed me to Florida, and again, Flagler College. A history professor asked me, "Are you by any chance related to Little Mary Fagan?" Then several classmates quizzed me about the story. I decided that I had to know the answers to the questions that haunted me. I just had to know. I couldn't be Mary Fagan without this shadow of my past. It was my history, my legacy, and I just had to answer those questions. I became friends with Amy. Amy was Jewish, and, as with all friends, religion came up between us. Amy and I exchanged our beliefs and answered the whys of our faiths. Of course, Judaism is not simply a faith, it's a genetic group. And being a religion is essentially something it hides behind. It's a mask or a shell for it to hide under. There were no barriers between us, Mary Fagan and her Jewish friend Amy. Once a group of us were talking and someone asked me in front of Amy that question, "Are you by any chance related to Little Mary Fagan?" "Yes," I replied. "Wasn't Leo Frank a Jewish man?" she persisted. I told her yes again, but Amy never mentioned the story of Little Mary Fagan, and I never told her. I never felt obliged to tell her more. It didn't have anything to do with our friendship. We were best friends, and that was that. My family delighted in my friendship with Amy and her family. During one Christmas vacation, Dad related to me how he had become part of a Jewish family. For the first time, I realized why I had always called this particular couple Grandma and Grandpa, and still do. It happened around Christmas time in 1952. My dad had just been promoted to Staff Sergeant and was flying out of the Warner Robins Air Force Base in Macon, Georgia. As Christmas approached, we geared up to make flights back east to provide transportation for all the military services, he explained. Plans were made that each flight would make certain strategic stops to drop off troops and pick them up after Christmas and bring them back to Larson Air Force Base. On December 20, 1952, there was a fatal crash that took the lives of about 87 young military men. That's December 20th, 1952, a fatal crash of killing 87 young military men. It was the worst military air disaster in history in December 1952. Airplane crashes are terrible in more ways than one. They create havoc in the loss of lives and materials, and they put men to a test that they cannot survive. The dead men must be escorted home for burial. The escorts are called color guards. They are hand-picked, as a rule, versed in the nature of life at its worst. Each family that has lost a loved one will have 1,000 questions to ask the color guard. He will have no answers and must rely on his own ability to handle the situation. As we move on to page 46. And no two will be the same. Some color guards will break under the pressure, particularly if they were friends. One of the crew members on the flight was my close friend Robert Jacobs. He was a radio operator whose position was on the flight deck with a pilot, co-pilot, navigator, and flight engineer. All of these crew members perished in that crash. I knew them all. Tears still come to my eyes when I think about it and how many lives it claimed. Brigadier General H.W. Bowman, commander of the 62nd Troop Carrier Wing, and Lieutenant Colonel Robert K. McCoskrie, M-C-C-O-S-K-R-I-E, commander of the 7th Troop Carrier Squadron, suffered only as commanders can suffer when they lose men in a tragic accident. Bowman and McCoskrie. As in any accident, the cleanup crew was mostly volunteers. These men are the true heroes. At times, some even risked their lives in trying to save others. It took over 3 days just to recover the bodies. And then there was the horrible task of identifying some of the bodies. Preparations and transportation arrangements were made, and then came the selection of the color guards. There was no Jewish man to escort our radio operator. One would have to be selected from another squadron, someone who did not even know his name, unless someone in our squadron would step forward to be his color guard. With head held high, tears in my eyes, my heart about to burst, I took that step forward. I could not allow a stranger to escort my friend and fellow crew member home to his parents. In my mind, that would hurt them even more. I felt that I would break under the pressure when I presented the American flag to Mr. and Mrs. Jacobs at the gravesite. I did. When I presented the flag to them, I could hardly talk for the tears rolling down my cheeks. This flag is presented to you by a grateful nation in remembrance of your loved one. For one moment, time stood still for three broken hearts. The parents and mine became one in grief. They invited me home to say the Kaddish, a memorial prayer for their son. That's a Jewish prayer. There was a famous poem by, I think, Allen Ginsberg, the pedophile Jew and famous poet of Howl and other garbage, called Kaddish, if I recall correctly. They invited me home to say the Kaddish, a memorial prayer for their son. I became an adopted son, and to this day I call them Mom and Dad. And you children call them Grandma and Grandpa. Every Mother's Day, I send flowers to my friend's mother. She's a very special person. All right, now we got to pause here because I got to explain something here. What they're trying to do is an old Jew hand like me is well aware, and you should be aware if you know anything at all about Jews. Here you have these typical sucker goys trying to go out of their way to demonstrate that they don't hate all Jews because of what one Jew did. But the Jews never go out of their way to say, we aren't all like that Jew who killed a member of your family. They don't feel any need to reach out to the goyish victim. Rather, they reach out to the Jewish perpetrator. So you see how there's a total, like, completely opposite reaction that is obviously biological and ultimate and genetic in origin, to where whites feel the need to demonstrate their bona fides, whereas Jews feel only the need to attack and accuse others, so that even when their own fellow Jew commits the worst possible crime imaginable, why, they don't side with the victim, they side with the Jew. And they're out there, if they can't accuse someone else, they can make up lies. They can say, oh, they were intimidating the court, they were yelling, hang the damn Jew, and the court and the jury heard it. And that's why they reached the conclusion, they lie. And they're networked, so their lies are effective, their lies are broadcast, their lies reach the ears of everybody, whereas the truth is limited to the family and the local circle. And over time, as they gain political control, they gain control in the academy, they gain lawyers and court control, they gain media control, they gain the consolidation of media, theirs becomes the only voice being heard. And that's the situation whites have been in for 100 years, at least until the internet came about, and you could listen to another pro-white man like me without a Jewish filter in between what I'm saying and what you're hearing. See, I'd happily be speaking to you from one of the professional conservative outlets or organizations, except they won't allow anything critical of Jews to go through their filter, nor will the left. So you're reduced to going elsewhere to find the truth, because what you get from the controlled media, or as I like to call them, the Jew-controlled media, the junk media, is always uniform when it comes to Jews and any group that the Jews are using or that is on the Jewish side as they see it. Those always receive complete indemnity, complete political, psychological indemnity. They can never be wrong, even when they're committing literal, overt, legal crimes. They're not wrong. It always traces back to the guilty white man. He's the one who has to prove that his moral bona fides. And this attitude somehow becomes communicated to white people, and they pick up on it. And I think it derives not just genetically, or it may be genetic ultimately in origin. They have hearts, they feel guilty, they have morals compared to these other races, but it's further inculcated, deepened, and entrenched by their church. The concept of original sin transposes very neatly onto racial stuff. If the main accusation against you now isn't sexual infidelity, which is la-di-da, it doesn't matter. Sexual stuff has become completely liberated, but political stuff has become the new morality, and it's original sin, what whites did to blacks, and we have to make up for it somehow. It's original sin, what whites supposedly did to Jews in World War II, and that's the Holocaust. And that's the worst thing that ever happened. And it was carried off by the worst people who ever happened, led by the worst man who ever existed, Jesus Christ. No, not Jesus, Adolf Hitler. You see how that works? And so you're saying I'm getting a lot out of little, but I've read 100 things like this. I know how Goyim think. I know how Jews think. See, they're going out of their way to prove that they're not biased against Jews because of stuff she's not saying. Now, maybe she gets into this later in the book. I'm reading it along with you for the first time. Maybe she gets into it later in the book how Jews have been making various accusations that someone was screaming, hang the Jew. She hasn't gotten into any of that overtly, but there's little, I don't know if you'd even go so far as to say hints, but there's little non-explicit allusions that I take to be clear examples that she has heard that Jews are claiming there was some bias involved. And that's prompted some of her questions. And even though she has heard what her father has said about her family's attitude, and she's heard his attitude directly, she still has some of her own questions. And this is the state she's in when she goes off to Flagler College and meets this Jew who becomes her friend. And hears more about her dad, as we're just hearing now, and how he's became the color guard for this Jew who was one of his flight crew, who was killed in this horrible accident in the 50s. Anyway, so much so that he goes home with the Jews, and they're calling him mom and dad and grandpa and grandma. Every Mother's Day, I send flowers to my friend's Jew mother. She's a very special person. They asked me questions I had no answers for, except the simple truths and personal knowledge that I had of their son. Of course they wanted to know why. I explained that their son was one of the best, and the best are always selected for the tough flights. I don't think that I would have the guts to do that job again. I was to receive four letters of appreciation and commendation, one from the Jewish War Veterans of the U.S., one from Brigadier General H.W. Bowman, commanding General 62nd Troop Carrier Wing, H., one from Colonel Richard Jones, commanding Officer 62nd Troop Carrier Group, H., and one from Lieutenant Colonel Roland McCoskrey, commanding Officer 7th Troop Carrier Squadron, H. Those letters are still in my personal folder today. Life takes a pause and then continues on. Back to the author again. After 2 years at Flagler, both Amy and I felt that it wasn't offering the programs we needed for our careers. We both transferred to Florida State University in Tallahassee, Florida, during the summer of 1974. I worked hard, and in August of 1977, I received my Master of Science in the College of Education program at Florida State University with honors. And what was even more exciting was I already had a job. I was to be the consultant slash itinerant teacher for the visually impaired for the Griffin Cooperative Educational Service in Griffin, Georgia. I would be going back home. I began at the agency the first week of September. I was introduced to the various superintendents of the systems in which I would be responsible for setting up the vision program. Several of the superintendents asked me that question, "Are you by any chance related to the Little Mary Fagan?" One of them privately called me in his office and sang me "The Ballad of Mary Fagan" by Fiddling John Carson of Blue Ridge, Georgia. Little Mary Fagan went, these are the lyrics. Little Mary Fagan went to town one day and went to the pencil factory to see the big parade. She left her home at 11 and kissed her mother goodbye. Not one time did the poor child think that she was going to die. Leo Frank met her, and with a brutal heart we know, he smiled and said, "Little Mary, now you will go home no more." He sneaked along behind her till she reached the metal room. He laughed and said, "Little Mary, you have met your fatal doom." She fell upon her knees, and to Leo Frank she pled. He took his stick from the trash pile and hit her across the head. The tears rolled down her rosy cheeks while the blood flowed down her back, but she still remembered telling her mother what time she would be back. He killed Little Mary Fagan. It was on a holiday, and he called on Jim Conley to take her body away. He took her to the basement. She was bound hand and feet. And down in the basement, Little Mary lay asleep. And then in the, that's the end of the lyrics. Then we have a bunch of pictures. Angelina Fagan with her daughters and grandchildren. Mary Fagan is right on her lap. That shows her as a young girl of maybe, I don't know, maybe two. Ali May and Mary Fagan. Mary is on the right. Shows her as, you know, a typical, it looks like 19th century, but I guess it would have been 20th century, just starting out. And then there's another picture. The farm Fanny Fagan moved to after the death of William Joshua. Big old building and family and chairs out in front of it outside. William Joshua and Fanny Fagan. Picture of a couple. The next picture, the Marietta Atlanta trolley in 1921. Marietta, some 20-25 miles from Atlanta. And back then they had, you know, horse-drawn carriages and streetcars. And then there's a postcard of women bathing in those old-style swimsuits. Other side addressed to Mrs. Fanny Fagan, East Point, Georgia. A postcard Mary Fagan sent to her mother in 1911. Large sort of childish script. And there's more lyrics, I guess that's from the same ballad. Picks up again. Newtley was the watchman when he went to wind his key. Down in the basement, Little Mary he could see. Remember, he found the body at like 3 a.m. on Sunday after she was murdered around noon on Saturday. He called for the officers. Newtley called for the officers. Their names I do not know. They came to the pencil factory. Says, "Newtley, you must go." They took him to the jailhouse. They locked him in a cell. But the poor innocent Negro knew nothing for to tell. I have a notion in my head that when Frank comes to die and stands the examination in the courthouse in the skies, he will be astonished at the questions the angels are going to say of how he killed Little Mary. on one holiday, Confederate Memorial Day. Come all you good people, wherever you may be, and supposing little Mary belonged to you or me. Her mother sat a-weeping, she weeps and mourns all day. She prays to meet her darling in a better world some day. Little Mary is in heaven, while Leo Frank is in jail, waiting for the day to come when he can tell his tale. Judge Roan passed the sentence, and you bet he passed it well. Solicitor Hugh M. Dorsey sent Leo Frank to hell. Now, God bless her mother. And that's the end of the song. Back to the author. He told me that his mother had sung the ballad throughout his childhood. Someone was singing this to her. He had never forgotten a word. While he was singing the ballad, I realized that little Mary Fagan was me, too, not a separate entity, and I could not evade our relationship, nor did I want to. I was ready to search for answers to those haunting questions that she mentioned at the end of chapter 2. Now I had to know if what my father taught me was accurate and factual. So this is how strong social conditioning is in whites, that even if their own parents tell them something, they don't believe it because they hear socially and through the controlled media that there's a different story, that the Jew is actually innocent, not guilty, as everyone thinks. And they come to doubt because what they're hearing comes from authority. So Goyim and perhaps Aryans in particular are too prone to believing and trusting authority. They can't rely enough on their own pure wit. They get easily, they're suggestible. They're easily baffled or discouraged when they hear external powers that be saying something they don't like or they don't agree with or they haven't heard. It scares and bollocks them. But they need to be stronger. Now I had to know if what my father taught me was accurate and factual. I began extensive research. I looked again at the brief of evidence, reference books, and the newspaper accounts in a different way, a critical way. I read everything I could find on the economic, political, social, and psychological climate of the South in 1913. By the time little Mary Fagan was murdered, the Civil War had been over only 48 years. Today, other parts of the country accuse Southerners of, quote, still fighting the Civil War, close quote. To an extent, that is true. It was true to an even greater extent in 1913. The focus of Southern society was tradition, which also meant opposition to change, and the commitment to tradition was often manifested in a loyalty on the part of Southerners, quote, to their own kind, which usually resulted in a paranoid suspicion of outsiders. So already she's starting to use anti-white language that's commonly spread by Jews. Another strong part of this tradition is the esteem in which white women, and particularly young white girls, are held. Southerners have always had a fear, whatever its origins, of assaults upon women. The industrialization, which began in the last part of the 19th century, centered on the cities, and it was in the rural areas that the commitment to tradition held most strongly. But life in rural areas was difficult. Very difficult for most of the poorer people, so they emigrated to urban areas. Apparently, life wasn't much better in the cities, although the opportunities to make money were far greater, and it was especially dreary in Atlanta. Those who came in from the country to find work in the mills and factories were white tenant farmers, and they lived for the most part in the bleak factory slums which surrounded Atlanta's industrial sections. Just as grandmother Fanny Fagan Coleman was preparing to move her fatherless children from Alabama back to Atlanta/Marietta around 1908 or 1909, about a third of Atlanta's population had no water mains or sewers. 2 years before little Mary Fagan was slain, between 50% and 75% of the school children of Atlanta suffered from anemia, malnutrition, and heart disease. Interesting. So right after 1910, 1911, 50 to 75% of the school kids of Atlanta suffered from anemia, malnutrition, and heart disease. In 1906, 22,000 out of a population of 115,000 were held by the police for disorderly conduct or drunkenness. That year, one of the worst race riots in memory broke out in Atlanta, and the newspapers seized upon stories, true or not, of Negro assaults on white women. Wages were low in the mills and factories, and the normal workday began at 6 a.m. and ended at 6 p.m. Mary Fagan had earned only 10 cents an hour at the National Pencil Company. Children were exploited, especially in the cotton mills. I thought of my father's description of his grandmother, Mary Richards Fagan, whom the factory bosses would hide from the labor inspectors. It was probably inevitable that family and community ties, another bulwark of tradition, began to weaken. Despite people's struggles to hold on to them, and they grew increasingly resentful of those whom they considered to be their exploiters. I realized as my research began to clarify a lot of things for me that little Mary Fagan, white, pretty, well-liked, just short of 14, a laborer in a factory or a sweatshop, came to stand for what was good, pure, sweet, and exploited about the South. So the people in the South identified with her and saw her as a example of the tough road they had to hoe. And that Leo Frank, a northerner, a Jew, superintendent, part owner of the factory, and well-to-do, would have fit perfectly the idea of the outsider, which Southerners traditionally held in such suspicion, and the exploiter of whom they were growing increasingly resentful. The entire family believed that he killed Mary Fagan. So did I. Well, that's good to hear. Now here's a block quote. On April 28, 1913, Leo Frank sent a telegram to Adolf Montag in New York. Atlanta, Georgia, April 28, 1913. Mr. Adolf Montag, CO, Imperial Hotel, care of Imperial Hotel, New York. You may have read in the Atlanta papers of a factory girl found dead Sunday morning in the cellar of a pencil factory. Police will eventually solve it. Assure my uncle I am all right in case he asks. Our company has case well in hand. Leo M. Frank. So that's a telegram that Leo Frank sent up to his Jew buddies in New York and his relatives. On April 29th, 1913, 3 days after little Mary's body was discovered, the Atlanta Georgian reported that four suspects were being held. The headline read, "Is the guilty man among those held?" These men were, one, a black night watchman, that'd be Newt Lee, who is thought to know much more about the crime than he is told, but who has not been regarded as the perpetrator. Two, a former streetcar conductor for whom a strong alibi has never been established and from whom suspicion is shifting. Three, a black elevator boy who has never been held as a material witness, but against whom no evidence has been obtained. Four, a former employee of the National Pencil Company who was located at the plant Saturday and identified as being, quote, the man with a little girl on Saturday night. In neither the conductor's nor the elevator boy's case do police place much dependence on the so-called identifications. Author again. All of these men were cleared. At that time, neither Leo Frank, the factory superintendent, nor Jim Connolly, the pencil factory janitor, appeared on the list. Leo Frank was at police headquarters that day, but police were quoted as saying, Frank is not under arrest, but that he was under police guard for his own personal safety, and that, quote, there are no charges against him, unquote. What led to the eventual arrest of Leo Frank, the factory superintendent? When Newt Lee, the night watchman who discovered the body of little Mary Fagan, was questioned by police, he stated that he had been working at the factory on April 26, 1913, and that when he began working at the pencil factory, that's that Saturday, Mr. Frank had told him to report at 6 p.m. on weekdays and at 5 p.m. on Saturdays. He said that on Friday, the 25th of April, Leo Frank told him, tomorrow is a holiday and I want you to come back at 4 o'clock. I want to get off a little earlier than I have been getting off. Frank had plans to go to the baseball game with his brother-in-law. The game started at 4 p.m. Newt Lee said that he arrived at the factory at about 3 or 4 minutes before 4. He then told the detectives, the front door was not locked. I pushed it open, went on in, and got to the double door there. I was paid off Friday night at about 6 o'clock. I was paid off Friday night at 6 o'clock. It was put out that everybody would be paid off then. Every Saturday when I get off, he gives me the keys at 12 o'clock so that if he happened to be gone when I get back there at 5 or 6 o'clock, I could get in, and every Monday morning I return the keys to him. The front door had always been unlocked on previous Saturday afternoons. After you go inside and come up about middle ways of the steps, there are some double doors there. It was locked on Saturday when I got there. Have never found it that way before. Have never found it that way before. I took my key and unlocked it. When I went upstairs, I had a sack of bananas, and I stood to the left of the desk like I do every Saturday. I says, like I always do, "All right, Mr. Frank," and he come bustling out of his office. He had never done that before. He always called me when he wanted to tell me anything and said, "Step here a minute, Newt." Then he came up rubbing his hands and says, "Newt, I am sorry that you had to come so soon. You could have been at home sleeping. I tell you what you do. You go out in town and have a good time." He had never let me off before that. I could have laid down in the shipping room and gone to sleep, and I told him that. He says, "You needs to have a good time. You go downtown, stay an hour and a half, and come back your usual time at 6 o'clock. I then went out the door and stayed until about 4 minutes to 6. When I came back, the doors were unlocked just as I left them, and I went and says, "All right, Mr. Frank." And he says, "What time is it?" And I says, "It lacks 2 minutes of 6. That's funny. My grandfather used to talk that way a little bit. He like it lack. It's that locution. It lacks 2 minutes of, or it's. I vaguely. It just occurred to me. I recall him saying stuff like that from time to time. Older locutions from the early part of the 20th century. Apparently in Missouri as well as down south. It's kind of a cool way of saying it, isn't it? It lacks 2 minutes of 6. He says, "Don't punch yet. There's a few work today, and I want to change the slip." It took him twice as long this time than it did the other times I saw him fix it. He fumbled putting it in while I held the lever for him, and I think he made some remark about he was not used to putting it in. When Mr. Frank put the tape in, I punched, and I went downstairs. While I was down there, Mr. Gant came from across the street from the beer saloon and says, "Newt, I got a pair of old shoes that I want to get upstairs to have fixed." I says, "I ain't allowed to let anybody in here after 6 o'clock. About that time, Mr. Frank come bustling out of the door and run into Gant unexpected, and he jumped back, frightened. Gant says, "I got a pair of old shoes upstairs. Have you any objection to my getting them?" Frank says, "I don't think they are there. I think I saw the boy sweep up some in the trash the other day. Mr. Gant asked him what sort they were, and Mr. Frank says, "Tans." Gant says, "Well, I had a pair of black ones, too." Frank says, "Well, I don't know," and he dropped his head down just so. Then he raised his head and says, "Newt, go with him and stay with him and help him find them." And I went up there with Mr. Gant and found them in the shipping room, 2 pair, the tans and the black ones. Mr. Frank phoned me that night about an hour after he left. It was sometime after 7 o'clock. He says, "How is everything?" And I says, "Everything is all right as far as I know." And he says, "Goodbye." There's a light on the street floor just after you get in the entrance to the building. The light is right up there where that partition comes across. Mr. Frank told me when I first went there, "Keep that light burning bright so the officers can see it when they pass by." So that's a light on the street floor just after you get in the entrance to the building. It wasn't burning that day at all. I lit it at 6 o'clock myself. On Saturdays, I always lit it, but weekdays it would always be lit when I got there. On Saturdays, I always got there at 5 o'clock. This is Saturday. He got me there an hour earlier and let me off later. There is a light in the basement down there at the foot of the ladder. He told me to keep that burning all the time. It has 2 little chains to it to turn on and turn off the gas. When I got there on making my rounds at 7 o'clock, on the 26th of April, that's again the Saturday where she's been killed like 7 hours earlier, and he's going to light the light. It was burning just as low as you could turn it, like a lightning bug. I left it Saturday morning burning bright. So someone's turned it down in the meantime from when he was there on Friday. I made my rounds regularly every half hour Saturday night. I punched on the hour and punched on the half, and I made all my punches. The elevator doors on the street floor and the office floor were closed when I got there on Saturday. They were fastened down just like we fasten them down every other night. When 3 o'clock came, I went down the basement, and when I went down and got ready to come back, I discovered the body there. I went down to the toilet, and when I got through, I looked at the dustbin back to the door to see how the door was, and it being dark, I picked up my lantern and went there, and I saw something laying there, which I thought some of the boys had put there to scare me. Then I got out of there. I got up the ladder and called up the police station. It was after 3 o'clock. This is in the a.m. wee hours of Sunday morning. So he goes to the bathroom and then he sees this body lying there, immediately comes back upstairs from the basement where it is and calls the cops. I tried to get Mr. Frank on the telephone and was still trying. I guess I was trying about 8 minutes. And that's the end of the Negro testimony from Newt Lee, the night watchman. L.S. Dobbs, sergeant of police, and J.N. Starnes, these are the cops who show up, city officer, went to the National Pencil Factory after receiving the call from Newt Lee, who gave the above. They discovered the notes, the two fake notes that Frank had the black write. They discovered the notes under the sawdust, a hat without ribbons on it, paper and pencils, and a shoe near the boiler, a bloody handkerchief about 10 feet further from the body toward the rear of the sawdust pile. While Dobbs was reading the notes, quote, "and land down, play like night," unquote, very ungrammatical, because it's supposed to be illiterate or semi-literate black writing it. When he said the word night, Lee said, "that means the night watchman." J.N. Starnes finally reached Frank by telephone around 6:30 a.m. and sent Boots, W.W. Rogers, with John R. Black after him. The earlier calls made by Lee and the police had not been answered, the calls to Leo Frank. Boots Rogers and Mr. Black said they found Frank extremely nervous and that he asked to eat his breakfast before leaving, a request the police denied him. Frank also denied knowledge of a little girl named Mary Fagan. They then took Frank to the morgue. They stated that he scarcely looked at the body and would not enter the room where it lay. He continued to be agitated and nervous, so he's acting guilty. Upon arriving at the factory, he consulted his time book and reported, "Yes, Mary Fagan worked here, and she was here yesterday to get her pay." He then told the police, "I will tell you about the exact time she left here. My stenographer left about 12 o'clock, and a few minutes after she left, the office boy left, and Mary came in and got her money and left." Further questioning revealed that Frank maintained he was inside his office every minute from noon to 12:30. On Sunday, he confirmed to police that the time slips punched by Newt Lee were correct, but the next day he said the time slips contained errors. Frank appeared at police headquarters on Monday morning with his attorneys, Luther Z. Rosser and Herbert Haas. R-O-S-S-E-R. I may have incorrectly said he was Jew. I don't know that he was a Jew. What the key was that Governor Slayton and Rosser were part of the same four-man legal firm. And a couple of the, at least two of the four, I believe, on that firm represented Leo Frank. So the guy who is commuting the death sentence of Leo Frank belongs to the same law firm as Frank's defenders, Jew or not. Jew or not, they were extremely high paid. They were the best legal talent you could raise with money in Georgia at that time. So Frank appeared at police headquarters on Monday, so this would be 2 days after Mary's killed, with his attorneys Luther Rosser, who may be a Jew, or he may not, may be German, maybe Luther, who knows, and Herbert Haas, certainly could be a Jew or a German, who evidently had been contacted on Sunday. Frank advised police that Newt Lee and J.M. Gant, G-A-N-T-T, had been at the factory and that Gant knew Mary Fagan very well. So Frank's trying to shed suspicion on others. He says, "Well, Newt Lee and J.M. Gant were at the factory and Gant knows Mary Fagan very well. Knew Mary Fagan very well," is in quotes. This led to their arrests. So they're assuming the superintendent is going to be a good acting guy. He's going to be a decent fellow. He'll help them. He won't interfere with them or impede them. But they still note that he's acting very nervously. Nevertheless, he mentions people who knew Mary who were at the factory, and they arrest them. On Monday morning, April 28th, when the factory opened, R.P. Barrett, a machinist, reported that he found blood spots near a machine at the west end of the dressing room on the second floor, which had not been there Friday. So a machinist sees blood spots that were not there Friday when they come into work on Monday. Hair was also found on the handle of a bench lathe and strands of cord of the type that were used to strangle Mary Fagan were hung near the dressing room. So her body's in the basement, is found in the basement, but this evidence is found Monday on the second floor where she worked. And I believe that, I think Frank's office was also on that floor. Leo Frank was arrested on Tuesday, April 29th. So she was killed on the 26th. He killed her on the 26th, and he was arrested on April 29th, Tuesday, and incarcerated in the Fulton Tower. The police said his hands were quivering and that he was pale. These would be signs of physical cowardice and extreme nervousness based on knowledge, not guilt. He again reported that technical guilt, but not moral guilt. He again reported that Mary Fagan came in, quote, between 12:05 and 12:10, maybe 12:07, to get her pay envelope, her salary. He stated, "I paid her and she went out of the office." Later that evening, Frank had a conversation with Newt Lee, who was handcuffed to a chair. Newt Lee reported that when Frank came in, he dropped his head and looked down. They were all alone, and Lee said, "Mr. Frank, it's mighty hard for me to be handcuffed here for something I don't know anything about." So, he may be black, but he didn't want to do time for something that his boss, this Jew, did. Frank said, "That's the difference. They have got me locked up and a man guarding me." Lee then asked, "Mr. Frank, do you believe I committed that crime?" And he said, "No, Newt, I know you didn't, but I believe you know something about it." Lee then said, "Mr. Frank, I don't know a thing about it, no more than finding the body." Frank said, "We are not talking about that now. We will let that go. If you keep that up, we'll both go to hell. We will both go to hell." So Frank is kind of working on him to get him to admit he had something to do with it. The police had also learned that Frank refused to send Mary Fagan's pay home with Helen Ferguson, a friend. Then, not too long after, so a means, motive, opportunity. Then, not too long after Leo Frank's indictment and Jim Connolly, again, the janitor's statements, the police also obtained a statement from Minola, M-I-N-O-L-A, McKnight, the black cook in the Frank home. She reported that when Frank came home that Saturday, he was drunk, talked wildly, and threatened to kill himself, thus forcing his wife to sleep on the floor. Minola's sworn statement was witnessed by her lawyer, George Gordon. So, this is a shrimpy little diminutive, sexually lecherous Jew who is very, very excitable. And he's the superintendent of this whole pencil factory. Yet 3 days later, Mrs. McKnight publicly repudiated her affidavit, claiming that she had signed it to obtain release from the police. It seems that while her original statement made the front of the newspapers, her repudiation was printed unobtrusively on an inside page. Other questions nagged at me. Now, you and I might think that, well, yeah, the Jews probably got to her and paid her off or gave her some good reason not to, to retract what she'd said. Other questions nagged at me. My family maintained that Mary Fagan had been violated. What did the medical evidence disclose? Was the blood found in her legs and underwear the result of rape or menstrual blood? Was undisputable evidence of rape found? Had she been bitten on the breasts? X-rays of her body had apparently shown teeth indentations on her neck and shoulder. Where were the X-ray records? Were the marks made by Leo Frank's teeth? Did Solicitor Dorsey have Mary's body exhumed a second time to check the marks against X-rays of Leo Frank's teeth? Was Leo Frank, quote, a, quote, pervert, as the state attempted to establish? The state had certainly enough people to state on the witness stand that he'd made sexual overtures to the female employees at the factory. But does that mean, did the answers to any of these questions mean, any of my questions mean, that Leo Frank killed Mary Fagan? On the Saturday following the murder, that'd be in early May after the murder, Montine Stover, a fellow worker at the factory with Mary Fagan, came forward to tell the police that she had come for her pay on April 26th, but was unable to collect it because Frank was absent from his office. Montine informed the police that, quote, "It was 5 minutes after 12. I was sure that Mr. Frank would be in his office, so I stepped in. He wasn't in the outer office, so I stepped into the inner one. He wasn't there either. I thought he might have been somewhere around the building, so I waited. I went to the door and peered further down the floor among the machinery. I couldn't see him there. I stayed until the clock hand was pointing to 12:10. Then I went downstairs. The building was quiet, and I couldn't hear a sound. I didn't see anybody. So basically, at the time at which Leo Frank said that Mary Fagan came into his office between 12:05 and 12:10, there was somebody there to see him, and he was not there, and he couldn't be found anywhere in the building. So he's lying. Stuff is adding up against him. On April 30th, 1913, a coroner's inquest began. Leo Frank repeated his story concerning his whereabouts on April 26. A point of contention between the police, the coroner, and Frank was Frank's physical location when the whistles blew. Since Saturday was Confederate Memorial Day, police argued that no whistles blew. Leo Frank had difficulty establishing his whereabouts during that time frame. Montine Stover, M-O-N-T-I-E-E-N, Stover, S-T-O-V-E-R, repeated the testimony which she had reported to the police at the coroner's inquest. On May 8, 1913, the jury returned a verdict of murder at the hands of a person or persons unknown. Both Frank and Newt Lee were returned to the Fulton Tower. Why did people feel it was Leo Frank rather than Newt Lee who was responsible for the murder? Some who have studied the Mary Fagan case seem to feel that many people in Atlanta, including the police and the Fulton County Solicitor General, Hugh Dorsey, demanded Leo Frank's indictment and conviction because of his status as an outsider. Moreover, the Atlanta Police Department had a series of unsolved murders on their hands and were desperate for a conviction. They were also pressured by the public, who vociferously demanded that Mary Fagan's assailant be discovered. Then there was Jim Connolly, the janitor. On rounding up witnesses from the National Pencil Company, they apparently paid special attention to Jim Connolly, who had been seen washing a shirt at a faucet in the factory, thereby causing an anonymous informer to suggest to the police there could have been blood on the shirt. And those may well have been an anonymous person put up to it by the Jews or someone they were in their employ to suggest that. Hell, Frank may have given him the shirt to wash and then had someone report on him. Connolly apparently began by lying. He told the police he could neither read nor write, but he could do both. Over the next few weeks, he gave four affidavits, the last of which helped convict Leo Frank, each of which told a different version than the previous one. Yet it was largely on his testimony that Leo Frank was found guilty of murder. Could Jim Connolly have been the culprit? It would have been easy to convict Jim Connolly, a semi-literate, poor, friendless Negro with a chain gang record. Leo Frank, on the other hand, a white man with allegedly rich relatives, would be another story. He could raise sufficient funds to defend himself vigorously and effectively. Why did they home in on Leo Frank? Some writers, says the author, such as Harry Golden in his book A Little Girl Is Dead, feel that many Atlantans were grossly anti-Semitic and accused Frank of the murder because he was Jewish. This, again, is Harry Golden would be a Jew, and this would be typical Jewish lying. To defend one of their own who is a pedophile murderer and rapist? Isn't that unbelievable? But that's how Jews are. That's why Schopenhauer called them the great masters of the lie. Their entire religion or their culture and their genes are based on lying and deceiving other people by way of deception. It's not just Mossad. It's not just their rubric. It's not just their slogan. It's the way of the entire race. We lied. It was what you did. It was how you got through life. That's what Monica Lewinsky said. Luther Otterbein Bricker, who was the pastor of the First Christian Church in Bellwood, where Mary Fagan went to Bible school, described the high feelings which ran through Atlanta regarding the murder of little Mary Fagan in a letter to a friend dated May 26, 1942. Though 30-plus years after the fact, which he allowed to be published in 1943. The letter states his impression upon hearing of the murder. There's an extended quote from the letter from basically her pastor. The letter states his impression upon hearing of the murder. But when the police arrested a Jew, and a Yankee Jew at that, all of the inborn prejudice against Jews rose up in a feeling of satisfaction that here would be a victim worthy to pay for the crime. From that day on, the newspapers were filled with the most awful stories, affidavits, and testimonies, which proved the guilt of Leo M. Frank beyond the shadow of a doubt. The police got prostitutes and criminals on whom they had something to swear anything and everything they wanted them to swear to, and reading these stories in the paper day by day, there was no doubt left in the mind of the general public but that Frank was guilty. And the whole city was in a frenzy. We were all mad, crazy, and in a blood frenzy. Frank was brought to trial in a mob spirit. One could feel the waves of madness which swept us all. Had I been a member of the jury that tried Frank, I would have assented to the verdict of guilty, for the jury did exactly as I wanted it to, and I applauded the verdict. End of the long quote. It has also been said that Solicitor General Hugh Dorsey had strong feelings about Leo Frank's guilt, and through the years there has been much speculation on what brought about Dorsey's certainty that Frank was guilty. In a 1948 study of the Mary Fagan-Leo Frank case, Henry L. Bowden, or Bowden, I'm saying Bowden since you know Bobby Bowden, Henry L. Bowden, or Bowden, reported a discussion with Hugh Dorsey that seems to shed light on the prosecutor's feelings about Leo Frank. Bowden had, in conversation with Dorsey, asked him just what it was that had made him suspicious of Frank, and Dorsey reportedly replied that someone had planted a bloody shirt in a well on the property where Newt Lee lived, and that as he and several of the force, including Boots Rogers, the local detective who, according to Dorsey, was the best detective around, were riding out to the property to check on the shirt, Rogers described to Dorsey Leo Frank's extreme, quote-unquote, uneasiness and nervousness when confronted with the murder at the factory. This, Dorsey related, had led him to be suspicious of Frank. So these rotten little Jews are planting evidence. They're doing exactly what their leftism hypocritically, cantingly denounces, which is using a position of authority to gain privilege. They have advantages others don't, and they're using them to perpetrate extreme unfairness, even to the point of trying to frame others for murders they committed. What they say and what they do are two different things, but they're a race built on it. The dual code. We treat our own one way, we treat you another. Anti-gentilism. They hate all non-Jews. There's the good guys who are the Jews, and there's the haters, the anti-Semites, the evil ones who are the dirty, filthy, hated goyim, whether black or white. Dorsey stated further, Dorsey the prosecutor, to Bowden that he had arranged that all the detectives and operatives on the case reported to him directly rather than to the police force, and that the two advantages of this were that the papers were not informed of every little thing that the investigation discovered, and moreover, that defense counsel were kept in complete ignorance as to what Dorsey's evidence consisted of and were therefore unable to prepare defenses in advance to such evidence. Well, that might be a necessary stricture when you're dealing with Jews who can afford to pay people to talk about the progress of the investigation, which if they're willing to plant evidence, they would surely be willing to do. Nearing the end of the chapter, but a couple more pages. Dorsey sought Frank's indictment for the following reasons. Frank had sent Newt Lee away, the night watchman. Frank had sent the night watchman, Newt Lee, away at 4 p.m., and then called the factory at 7 p.m., which Lee claimed Frank had never done before, to check that things were all right. So, you know, those who say Jews are super smart, that's not a smart thing to do if you're breaking your pattern. Hey, so how's everything going? Haven't found any dead bodies, have you? Huh? No? Yeah, great. That's great. I'll see you Monday. Frank had not answered Newt Lee's or Captain Starnes' telephone calls when they're calling him in the very early morning after the body's found at 3 a.m. He hadn't wanted to come to the factory. He had said he couldn't tell if Mary Fagan worked at the factory since he didn't know the names of most of the factory girls. Again, this stupid little Jew has hit on Mary before, and he knows that other people know this, but he still lies. Lying is as reflexive as breathing among Jews, as a wise man once said. He had said he couldn't tell if Mary Fagan worked at the factory since he didn't know the names of most of the factory girls. Later at the office, he was able to tell the exact time Mary had come for her pay on Saturday. Frank had then accused J.M. Gant of being intimate with Mary Fagan, although earlier Frank had said he hadn't known her. The police officers who had taken Frank to the mortuary recalled his extreme nervousness. They now considered this emotional agitation important, as well as the fact that Frank had inquired about their finding Mary Fagan's pay envelope. At the inquest, J.W. Coleman stated, "Mary often said things went on at the factory that were not nice and that some of the people there tried to get fresh. She told most of those stories to her mother." Yet the defense for Frank never asked Fannie Fagan Coleman any direct questions about this. Of course, the state had other witnesses and perhaps chose not to upset the mother any more than was necessary. And we talked about that. We remember Tom Watson wrote a long article about this in his magazine, Watson's, and he also published a newspaper called the Jeffersonian. So white papers serving the white community were owned by men like Tom Watson, who shared their views. Back then, Jews didn't own all the major media. There wasn't one newspaper towns where it was owned by a Jew, not even living there, promoting an anti-white editorial line and not allowing any other view in. Back then, whites like Tom Watson owned papers like the Jeffersonian, and they could promote the general white viewpoint and advocate and look out for white interest. In 2015, it's not the case. The only people looking out for white interests are not in the mass media, not in the general media, not in the general politicians, but purely online among private people. And that's what it looks like when one race is being vanquished. It starts with lying, and they move from there to carry out a campaign of white genocide. They eventually want to do to the entire white race what Leo Frank did to Mary Fagan. Make it die, kill it off, prevent it from reproducing, prevent it from having a happy life. If you think that's an exaggeration, it's purely because you don't know enough about Jews. So the Frank's defendants, the lawyers defending him, the best in the state, don't dare to open up certain avenues of inquiry because they are going to show Leo Frank for what he was, a rotten little shrimpy little Jew who is continually hitting on these poor little exploited, underpaid white children working in his factory. Additional information which seemed to point to Leo Frank's guilt was his failure to throw suspicion on Conley, who testified that he helped Frank dispose of the body and his concealment of his ballgame date. Most importantly, Dorsey felt that Frank's cook, Manola McKnight's, first statement was true. Here's an extended quote. "Sunday, Miss Lucille said to Mrs. Selig," there's a good Jew name, "that Mr. Frank didn't rest so good Saturday night. She said he was drunk and wouldn't let her sleep with him, and she said that she slept on the floor on the rug by the bed because Mr. Frank was drinking." So he kills Mary Fagan noon to 12:30. He does a shitty job of trying to hide the body. He sends a night watchman out back and forth, and then he goes out and gets wasted, comes home and is acting just crazy and talking suicide, and his black maid notices all this, and his wife notices it too. His wife has to sleep separate from him. Miss Lucille said Sunday that Mr. Frank told her Saturday night that he was in trouble and that he didn't know the reason why he would murder, and he told his wife to get his pistol and let him kill himself. I heard Miss Lucille say that to Mrs. Selig, and it got away with Mrs. Selig mighty bad. She didn't know what to think. I haven't heard Miss Lucille say whether she believed it or not. I don't know why Mrs. Frank didn't come to see her husband, but it was a pretty good while before she would come to see him, maybe 2 weeks. So she knows that he's guilty. And I think she refused to be buried by him, too. She would tell me, wasn't it mighty bad that he was locked up? She would say, Manola, I don't know what I'm going to do. The affidavit of Montine Stover, and that's the woman, again, who was in there at the time that Frank said that Mary was coming to get her paycheck, and she didn't see him there anywhere, 12:05 to 12:10. The affidavit of Montine Stover following the coroner's verdict added credence to Dorsey's suspicions that Frank was the murderer, since Miss Stover reported that she got to the office at 12:05 p.m. to get her pay, and Frank wasn't there. This contradicted Frank, who had said he was continuously in his office from 12 noon on. So lie, 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 lie. Nervous behavior, crazy behavior, crazy behavior. Dorsey also weighed heavily on the record and comments of the jury. which pointed to their theory that the murder took place on an upper floor of the factory and that the body was taken to the basement with the intention of burning it. There were other comments by jury members in the factory being used by Frank for immoral purposes and his relations with some of the female employees. Not yet sure of whom the actual murderer was, Dorsey had indictment forms drawn up for both Leo Frank and Newt Lee. On May 24th, however, after the last testimony was heard, he asked for a true bill against Frank. The jury complied and returned an indictment charging Leo Frank with first-degree murder. And that ends right about the hour mark. That ends the Chapter 3. And I think it's fairly self-explanatory what's going on here. She's investigating. She's not finding anything that disagrees with what her family believed. Even the Jews, with all their propaganda power, there's not much they can really do to hide the facts of what went on here. My name is Alex Linder. Everything that I record, all of these sessions for the Learning College Vanguard audiobooks, can be found at vnnforum.com, the Massive, and the audiobooks file, and other files. Thank you for being with me today, and I'll be with you again very, very soon.